Ready? I'm Aaron Nathans.
And I'm Michael G. Ronstadt, and you're listening to
The Nathans and Ron Cast.
I beat you to the end. You're listening to. I know. Well, it's only because you did every other one, I think. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to jump right into our interview with Kenneth Stewart. Ken is, just like Peter Blatchley, Ken is his own brand of Renaissance person, and he's an expert at classical music and the knowledge of the history of classical music, and he knows all about 12-tone music.
12-tone music, which is a fascinating, somewhat archaic form of music that was created mostly to challenge people and to challenge their patience, perhaps, in listening to it.
It was trying to create different sounds,
right,
that you haven't heard before. It is a tool of tonality and the lack thereof. Welcome, Kenneth Stewart.
Kenneth Stewart.
Kenneth D. Stewart is a phenomenal musician on cello and guitar. He's an educator. He is a composer. He is actually a recording engineer and mix engineer, because I've heard his work in that front. It's amazing. He loves to teach. He loves to study. He loves to connect. He's an improviser. He plays any genre. Put an instrument in front of him, but specifically, I've been hearing tons of jazz recently, classical, of course, but country and Western, and, you know, all those things.
We have both types of music, bud, country and Western.
We're both cello players. We're both guitar players. We both grew up jamming in multiple genres out in Tucson, Arizona. So I want everyone to welcome Ken Stewart.
Hello, Ken.
Hi.
What is dissonance? Why don't you give us an example of something that is not dissonant and then that is?
So, like, dissonance in a lot of ways, my sort of TED Talk definition of dissonance is a musical sound with expectations.
Hmm.
Right? So I'll just use, I'm gonna use a more tonal definition of dissonance here real quick. I'm gonna go ahead and turn this up and I'll move the microphone. So, right? Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, right? Like, that's the sort of the classic tonal scale in the major mode. And one of the dissonances from within that we often look at is this one. Right? This is This is fa and si or ti, fa, do, re, mi, fa, and sol, la, ti. So fa and ti, that resolves thusly. Right? And so this first one is like a little bit more, we'll say, controversial a sound as an object that resolves to something that's a little bit more pleasant or resolved as a musical object. That's not the only musical object from within the major and minor scale that comes with sort of dissonance and expectations. It's oftentimes the first one grabbed to sort of demonstrate that principle of, like, oh, here is what's called a tritone or three whole steps. And then if I put the right bass note underneath it, then when it finally resolves, it makes a lot of musical sense to the ears. There are others. Right? Like, there are other ways of using these tonal materials that can create this feeling of what's called tension and release. Those are the sort of academic terms for this principle. You know, vacillating or changing or oscillating or going back and forth between sounds of tension, right? Sounds of tension, and then sounds of release, and then sound of tension, and then sound of release.
So right? are you defining the dissonance as the tension?
Yes.
In this situation? And
so those intervals are called, from a categorical perspective, those intervals are called dissonances. Now, if we are, so I still haven't left tonal music yet. We're still in C major, right? Like, we still haven't ventured very far, but we still have all the same words that we'll analyze Ornette Coleman and Schoenberg with, but we're just, we have our C major hat on still. Okay. So, in tonal music, tonal meaning center or a tonic, meaning that the focal point of all of the musical tension is geared toward principles of tension and release from within this system that like says that we have a home, right? So if I'm gonna improvise a chord progression right now, that's gonna be fairly conventional, right? So if I go like, right? Something. Right?
Yeah.
Like this, it's still from within the system because ultimately I could go. Yeah, I could still resolve home or somewhere else. There's still this pull of home. Now, if I were to abstract these individual sounds, so say I liked just tritones or just sevenths categorically. So to sort of say, okay, well, screw the tonal system. I'm now going to create cohesion and unity by taking these musical objects themselves, just these what are called intervals or sets of note relationships, and place them side by side. Then you start getting into a vocabulary that you would call atonal music, right? So it's sort of like, you know, it's not sort of like saying, well, there's Democrats and there's Republicans, but then over there are anarchists, right? It's sort of like atonal music still implies that somewhere lurking is some sort of tonal system. Like to sidestep it is to sort of still kind of acknowledge its political existence in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So here, I'm going to do an improvisation where the only thing that I'm going to be doing is using this tritone interval, right? Which was the, I call it the ti-do, right? Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti-do, right? That's our archetypal tonal cadence. But this interval, everything I'm playing melodically, I'm moving by steps, but I'm leaping by these tritones. Everything that I've played is based on. Right? So now I've extrapolated or I've pulled out of the tonal system a musical object of my preference. And I've now created musical unity by saying, I'm going to use that and only that, or I'm going to use that plus just maybe one or two other things.
And who is Schoenberg?
So Arnold Schoenberg, he is Austrian. So he was born in Vienna.
That is about the only thing I know about classical music, by the way. So
it's awesome. No. I appreciate it. So when I said Germanic, that's sort of what I mean. German speaking. And yes, he is Austrian. So was from Vienna. This was a composer that worked in the early 20th century. He was born in the 19th century and then sort of straddled, born in 1874, died in 1951, was prominent, you know, was working and writing music through World War I, pre-World War I, into World War II, and then was persecuted by Hitler himself. His music was considered degenerate, according to the Third Reich. Later immigrated to the United States and ultimately set up shop in L.A. He lived out the rest of his years in L.A., teaching for UCLA. And I don't know, there's something about the Los Angeles climate, apparently. It's like hilarious because like so did Stravinsky. Like one of the two most important composers in all of the sort of European art world, Igor Stravinsky and Schoenberg all found themselves in the sort of like 40s and 50s in LA. It was just crazy that became like a real center, yeah. You know, I don't know, just total beach bums. I imagine them just like, just covered in suntan lotion, just like sitting like, you know, just gawking at the beautiful bodies on the beach.
Probably.
You know, in my mind, of course, that's something. So Schoenberg is Uncle Arnie. Uncle Arnie was sort of like known for really shepherding this journey of European art composers from the tonal music space that I described, right? Which is really based on having a key, establishing a key, subverting a key, right? Tonal music can also mean avoiding resolving a key, but the fact that you're avoiding it means that you have it. You know what I'm saying? That's where sort of what I'm kind of getting at. Leading into what he called the emancipation of dissonance. And so there's that word meaning sort of controversial sound again, and saying that like, oh, okay. Now let me just take a moment, and I'm gonna break things down based on the major scale still, because I think for our ears it's one of the best things that we can do. So I have this do re mi fa sol la ti do, right? All of those intervals are either what we call perfect or major. Perfect sounds are like sounds that you would find in a lot of like Celtic guitar, the violins, the mandolins, guitars, cellos. They're all tuned to these perfect, or what I like to say is resonant intervals. These are intervals that occur low in the harmonic series, which is an acoustic phenomenon of musical vibrations. Right? Like fourths, fifths, and octaves, there's not a whole lot of musical substance to them. They're very transparent, but they're very acoustic. Power chords are these resonant intervals. And then the rest of the intervals in the major scale are all major. So you've got like major second, major third, major seventh, major sixth, right? So if I were to use all of the available dissonances, though, it would be like, so if I'm playing on all the white keys, now all of a sudden I'm going to like start using the black ones. Right? So that's where the word chromatic comes from. Chromatic in music, meaning not just do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, but like all the other ones. And so then you have this this real mishmash of you have a wide variety of intervals, major ones, minor ones, perfect ones, dissonant ones, augmented ones, da, 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 da. And you can sort of hear that. It's like it's much harder to create a kind of a unity to the whole, right? So Arnold Schoenberg was one of the is credited with being. There were lots of others in America. We had composers like Henry Cowell, Charles Ives. At Hungary, we had Béla Bartók. Mm-hmm. In England, there were composers like I'm trying to remember. Edward Elgar was a little more sort of conservative, but there were other cats, French composers like Edgard Varèse, whom you mentioned in 12 Tone Girl. Yeah. Like to put this all on Schoenberg, I'm saying is a little bit of a an apocryphal thing to sort of say. However, to trace his music is to tell the story of Euro-American art music in the 20th century. Like if you followed no other composer and just trace his work, it would parallel the journey that most of the music at the time traced for the most part. And so he went from tonal music early in his career, pieces that you mentioned, for example, Verklärte Nacht, which means transfigured night, which is a beautiful piece of tonal music. All the way through, like these the piano pieces that started to kind of pull away. and then all the way into what you're referencing by the title of your song, dodecaphonic music or 12-tone music. Well, 12-tone meaning that there is a system by which we are going to be using all 12 of the tones. There's 88 piano keys, but they repeat, right? You've got like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's like 8 C's, for example, or like there's 8 B flats, but there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's like 7 E's all throughout the span of the piano. So it's not saying specific piano keys. No, it's saying that there's a system by which we're going to be ordering our notes, C, then maybe to F or D flat, like just the there's something about the order of the pitches that's going to be serving two functions. One is not expressing tonality, and two is creating some sort of expected unity that we as listeners are hoping for. Mm-hmm. So it has to both create some sort of unity, except it can't be tonal. Like some other, like some form of unity that just isn't that other thing, please. Like that's kind of the whole rules of it. This is like the whole organization is like, you can do anything, but you can't do that, right? It's like the meatloaf system of, you know, yeah. I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that. It's like, you can do anything with these notes except, oh, create a tonal system that's a lot like Beethoven and Bach. That's we don't want you to do that. We've done that. But other than that, you could do anything you want. But just don't do that.
So, this is our commercial break. It's a short one.
It's a short break. Perhaps the shortest that we've ever had.
I know. But I keep thinking about your dating lives out there. You know, if you happen to be dating someone who only enjoys 12-tone music, this song is for you, essentially.
If you need to go out there and find 12-tone music happening live near you, we have listings of 12-tone music productions.
Yeah,
On our website.
Yes, exactly. So go to our website, find out where the closest 12-tone concert is, and be there. And Basil, you are the star right now. I bet you like 12-tone music.
Do you like 12-tone music, Basil? Yeah, dogs tend to love it because it's played in their frequencies.
Exactly. Back to the interview.
The whole premise of our song is that this is difficult music, and it's kind of ironic because 12-tone girl. I imagine that most of the people that were into 12-tone, I can't think of a single female 12-tone composer. Do you know of any?
Okay, so the one that, what's very interesting, actually, yes, I can. So I would highly recommend, as my first sort of musical shout out, would be to listen to Ruth Seeger's, I think it's the string quartet from 1931. This is a piece of serial music or 12-tone music. It's a very challenging piece of music to listen to. However, it's really incredible. So Ruth Crawford, she ended up marrying the musicologist Charles Seeger, who was Pete Seeger's, she was basically Pete Seeger's stepmother. So,
well, I've got a song about Pete Seeger too, but go ahead.
Sick. Well, so here's this crazy intersection, and this always happens, right? Like I'm a contemporary composer, come jazz musician, come sort of like more of a roots or Appalachian musician. A lot of the bluegrass musicians that I know from this area are also like either like into some other weird, like either noise rock, or like into circuit bending, or there's always something that's like very traditional and very avant-garde in all of our tastes. And I think Ruth Crawford is no exception to this. So fun fact, Ruth Crawford did the transcription of William Stepp's take on Bonaparte's Retreat that Copland orchestrated that became the rodeo from the Hoedown.
Oh, that's where that came from.
So she transcribed this 78 recording of this fiddle player, that I'm trying to remember who it was Agnes DeMille, I think. Yeah. So Agnes DeMille commissioned Rodeo, and she basically sent Aaron Copland these Ruth Crawford transcriptions, and then he orchestrated them. So he didn't do the musicology of actually going to the source material, finding these fiddle players, finding a lot of this stuff, doing some of this early, you know, ethno and anthropological research. He basically orchestrated it, right? It's pretty contentious. Right. I'll say that I went to an old time jam at my friend's house, and there was somebody there. It was like sort of like a house party where there was like people picking in like every room, and everyone's drinking, and there's just a wild party. And he sort of said, "Tell me about yourself," you know? I said, "Oh, I'm a composer." He said, "Cool. So are you going to like steal everything here?" Right? Like it's not particularly cool to be a composer in that musical scene, right? Mm. It's a little more nuanced than that. But Aaron Copland's sort of take on this William Stepp version of Bonaparte's Retreat that was done in sort of Dead Man's Tuning, which is like D, D, A, D, I think is the fiddle tuning. You know, you could allege just straight up cultural appropriation. I mean, I don't think that that's ridiculous. Now, I'm not sitting here trying to say that we need to cancel Rodeo. I think it's a great ballet. I think Martha Graham, even in sort of like the field of dance, like did some really revolutionary stuff with it.
My grandmother studied with her.
I mean, that's amazing, right? Like this is really, really important American music. But to actually trace the journey of how those notes got there, right? So Ruth Crawford is somebody that I really admire, not only for her work as a contemporary composer or as a modernist, I'll say, not contemporary, but as a modernist in the early 20th century, but then late career, then turned around and made significant contributions to fiddle repertoire and to sort of American roots heritage. But yes, mostly men.
Well, yeah, it's aggressive music, isn't it? Yeah. It's there's some machismo in this.
There is, although I will say, few things are more dissonant than Ruth's string quartet. But yes, absolutely. You need not look further than a piece of music that isn't actually 12 tone, but is one of Schoenberg's most famous works called Pierrot Lunaire.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. That's. I remember actually really enjoying that in school.
It's a really interesting piece. I had the wonderful opportunity to hear it live. I recommend hearing it live because it's way more theatric. Not only are the musical note choices a bit aggressive and sort of macho, as you say, but also the use of techniques. So the singer is doing a thing called Sprechstimme, which is half singing, half speaking. It's scored for a flute double piccolo, clarinet double bass, violin double viola, cello, piano. So the actual instrumentation itself is like a little mini orchestra. And the techniques that are being asked of the musicians are like, I'm thinking specifically of a technique for the flute called flutter tongue, where you go, right? Where you actually like buzz while playing the flute. You know, that's, you know, you're not really going to be hearing Ian Anderson do that, although a little bit. I don't want to be too black and white here, but these extended flute techniques combined with extended clarinet techniques combined with Sprechstimme combined with really dissonant vocabulary make something that sounds really weird and comical, right? Like what Michael, you were saying about a lot of the young kids in youth orchestra laughing at this music. It creates something that's very unusual and a little more off-putting is not quite the right word, but you know, not your traditional cup of tea in terms of straight ahead, to borrow the jazz term, straight ahead playing on your instrument.
And one of the things that I've noticed is I recently helped premiere a composition with that ensemble. So they call it the Pierrot Ensemble a lot of times with, you know, and as classically trained musicians, you know, oh yeah, okay, that's this instrumentation and cool. And so as a cello player, it's nice that you're included in it, you know?
No. Absolutely. It's like saying string quartet. Pierrot has become just the term for that.
Yeah.
right? Like, and that's the extent to which someone like Arnold Schoenberg has entered into, at least in the academic vernacular, is that you can say Pierrot ensemble and not actually be referring to Pierrot Linnaire, but rather the genre of pieces that are written for that same instrumentation that have come for the last, you know, 100 years since. It's a fairly large repertoire. There are a number of musical ensembles that have that same instrumentation. You know, it's sort of like for example, Bill Monroe is credited in the Bluegrass Boys and, you know, some of the, like, you know, a lot of the stuff that comes from Kentucky were like codifying this idea that, like, that for the most part, a bluegrass band is mandolin, guitar, banjo, bass, and, you know, either fiddle or dobro, or, you know, like these specific ones doing that specific thing is that.
Yeah.
That's what that sort of piece became, right?
It kind of highlights in a way you could joke around all day, like, oh yeah, 12-tone music. Oh, it sounds random or something. Ken, you and I were talking about this a little beforehand. And I always wanted to say, well, you know, it's not random. You know, it is decided upon and there is a form to it. And at some level, we feel that organization, I'm sure. But it's interesting to see, like, how you're talking about Ruth Crawford Seeger and how she's had a lasting legacy. She was between the two, you know. So my question is, and this is a stupid question, but there are no stupid questions. So is 12-tone music dead, or is it a tool? In my question, addendum would be like, is it a tool that composers use today to create stuff still, but it's used just maybe on a more subtle level or a more a deeper level, because we have so much, it's like computer programming built on top of it. You know, like it's, right. It's like, how is it used?
Right.
And how is it applicable? You've already explained the applicability of these things, but how they're connected.
Yeah. To a certain extent. Yeah. Okay. So, right. So I would say, all right. So my answer just right away is that yes, it's dead, sort of. And then yes, it is also
mostly dead.
Mostly dead in the sense that, like, okay. Well, so first of all, you know, shout outs to YouTubers like David Bruce, to people like Tana Kroll, Adam Neely, 12 Tone, pardon the pun, but like there's a YouTube channel of music education theory shorts by a person whose moniker is 12 Tone. I'm not familiar with his actual name. But like one of the discussions is like, how relevant is the academic concept of contemporary music kind of in the wild, right? That's something that's, I think David Bruce has a video called "The Overwhelming Irrelevance of Contemporary Music," right? So to call 12-tone music dead is also to, I think, miss a little bit of the point, because like academic music itself, there's not really, let's put it in the context of the NCAA. Like, I think that it's a really, really important thing that there's like a lot of corporations and video game makers that are making money on the intellectual property and the physical likeness of young players that are like barely 18. And should they be getting some of that pie? I think so. I think that young athletes should probably be getting some of this money that's being distributed amongst the powers that be that are making the sort of, you know, NCAA college basketball jam for PlayStation and Xbox. There's a lot of money being exchanged on the backs of a lot of these young kids that are not able to advocate for themselves. But is there something equivalent in the music industry that's similar to the NCAA for music? Like, are we following the draft of like, oh, did you hear that like Sophia Lorenzo's graduating from Indiana University? Wow. You know, like, is there like are we following music like sports? No.
No.
But are there organizations like the American Composers Orchestra or teaching organizations, like the Atlanta Symphony has composers residencies, the Philadelphia Orchestra has composers in residencies, New York City has the symphony space. You know, like, yes, there are, like, if you think about it as being like sports, but not famous. Yes, there are organizations in which students are graduating and getting placed into and things like this. So it's very much a double-edged sword, right? Like to say, like, is this compositional practice relevant? It's like, well, it's also kind of dealing with larger contexts of relevancy and irrelevance too. I found that in the last 10 years, the tolerance for only notated music to be pretty low. Like it's, I'm not gonna say a trendy thing, cause that implies that it's, I don't know, a fad, but I think that it's really important that there's a lot more of an open-mindedness toward improvisation as a practice in contemporary music. I think, Michael, you mentioned Keiko Abe and the use of what's called indeterminacy, which is where the composer gives you notes and then you get to kind of do what you want with them. Right? Like indeterminacy is like saying 12 tone. It's like saying that the composer made a decision of to how the piece is organized, and then here's how it plays itself on the surface of the music. And yeah, I think 12 tone music to this day has become sort of like a bit of a, and I don't mean this term pejoratively, but yes, it is a tool. It is a tool for musical organization, one of many, in the same way that like using chord symbols, like jazz charts. You know, lots of composers these days that will, in certain passages, facilitate improvisation by just using jazz chord symbols. Mm-hmm. You know, like, is that jazz? Well, no. But are we using some of the vocabularies and tools associated with that music in order to facilitate these other things? Yes. Right. I wanted to share with you guys that I was doing my homework prior to this. I was looking up dodecaphonic music, 12-tone music, and reading some wiki articles on it. And there is a Wikipedia article that is called List of Tone Rows and Series. So here's this list. And when you organize by date, the latest composition is 1989. So anyway, point being is that here are these composers that are either alive or like just passed away that have composed dodecaphonic music. And a lot of times like these tone rows, let's talk math for just a split second. 2 to the power of 12, we're dealing with the order of pitches. It's like cards. There are thousands of possible tone rows.
What is a tone row?
A tone row is an organization of 12 pitches. So it's the chromatic scale. Like, chromatic scale is a tone row. Here, I'm going to play C to B. A combination of the 12.
If you put it into just numbers, it's like saying, okay, 1, 3, 2, 4. You could put it in any order, 1 through 12.
Usually,
in any
most of the time, like a programming array, it starts with 0. So you'd say like 0, it's like 0 to 11, and it's some order of the notes.
Can you play us 3 different tone rows?
Yeah, sure. So the one that I'll give is the chromatic scale. So that's just like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I'm going to go, okay, here's one by Arvo Pärt from 1966 from his Symphony Number 2. So 0, 3. Here's Igor Stravinsky's from the Requiem Canticles. It's an order of the 12.
Do you remember your tone row on the cello piece you wrote?
It involved a sort of sequencing fourths. Yeah. It's basically go up a fourth because, okay, so for context, it was like, it was a protest piece for the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan from 2003. So I was playing around with the military trumpet funeral call taps. And so the fourth is an organizational device. So what I did was I stuffed a bunch of fourths into this tone row. So like you could go. Right. And so it's like my whole organizational system of writing this tone row was, I'm going to put a bunch of taps quotes. You have the halfway point, and then you have the next, and then you have, that was in thirds. Here's in fourths. Here's in fifths, here's in sixths, right? And so with those notes alone, which is be like how the trumpet works or the horn or any of the brass instruments, I could literally play. You can play taps just on the harmonics of a string, or just on the harmonics of a bugle. It's a major chord. So remember that whole thing about saying that tonal music is avoiding tonality? But yet here is this artifact that's like macho chord. It's like only chord. It's like only tonality. So to construct a 12-tone row that makes reference to taps, it's a bit missing the point on purpose. One of my early teachers that I had when I was in my early teens, Dr. Solomon said, it may be 12-tone, but this piece is tonal. He said, I hate to break it to you, Ken. You succeeded in writing a 12-tone piece, but you failed in writing something atonal. He said, but that's fine. He said, it's a beautiful piece. But I just want you to know that like that your materials are so tonal, it's tonal, right? Mm. So what I was demonstrating was the construction of the tone row being. And then. Just so this piece that I did is for solo cello that Michael has recorded is like where it's I lean into the taps. My form of protest was to create something 12-tone out of this to sort of lean into both the dissonance of it by saying, mm-hmm. For lack of a better word, hey, this is this fucked up thing that's like happening in the world. None of us have any agency. Oh, by the way, it turned out to be a lie. So what can I do? Well, I can take the major chord of a bugle call and I can turn it into a 12-tone row. Mm-hmm. That was my form of musical protest. In a lot of ways, sort of disrupting the tonality of that.
Well, and that defines in many ways, you were talking about your whole career in school has been defined by 9/11 to
the Orange Man. Yeah,
yeah. But in your own world, it's like every composer has the thing they're expressing, their life experiences, they're right. Expressing the stuff around them.
It is very funny, right? Like this is by far the most political my work has ever been, mm-hmm. was this particular piece. It landed really, really hard. I was a guest on the show From the Top. I played it on Minnesota Public Radio that was nationally syndicated.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our next young performer from Tucson, 18-year-old composer and cellist, Kenneth Stewart.
It's one of my more successful pieces. I'm actually like more of a chilled out, I'm like more of a patterns guy than a political guy, you know?
For me, the way you built it, I'm like, this is an introduction to the concept. And it was my introduction to the concept in a way that hit hard. And Aaron, that's how, like when we were writing it, I was like, this is how I'm going to do this 12-tone hook. And I've had some people say, are you going to put any 12-tone music in there? And I'm like, well, it kind of is in a way. The material's there. It's just hidden behind a thing, you know?
I mean, there's so to just give a couple more historical artifacts to your guys' song. One is that there's a very famous violin concerto by one of Arnold Schoenberg's students named Alban Berg.
Seen that live. It's quite beautiful.
It's a gorgeous piece. And he was very, very famous for being able to actually use tonal organization with the 12-tone row to be able to quote a chorale of Bach. So like the chorale he uses is Ich habe genug, which means like I am full or I've had enough, meaning of the spirit. I am full of the spirit. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about that particular chorale melody that actually Bach did not compose, but merely harmonized, is that it has what's called a whole tone fragment, or that the melody, it uses three whole steps or outlines this tritone interval. So it is actually the most dissonant of all of the chorale melodies. And so Ich habe genug sort of lent itself to this technique, and Alban Berg was able to actually quote Bach and still maintain this 12-tone technique in doing so. One of the things that I just want to take a moment and acknowledge here is that, like, you don't, I mean, sometimes in the academic music sphere, maybe you do, but in general, you don't get a gold star by adhering to a musical system.
Yeah.
Right. Like you just really don't. I don't know. Like, say you guys ended up writing a song where you used every word that rhymes with both orange and purple, but the song sucks. Like, you don't get any points for doing some sort of formalist musical device. So I think what's significant about the Alban Berg Violin Concerto is that it's stunningly beautiful. I think what's really significant about that was his ability to kind of counteract some of what Arnold Schoenberg was doing with the system, which was to write music that was highly dissonant. And Alban Berg was actually writing music that was very aesthetic, very tonal in its harmony. The opening of the Violin Concerto itself. Has the open strings of the violin. Not only does it quote the violin, but the open strings. The open strings of the violin even play into the tone row. So there's like, so using this, you know, I'm much more of a Berg kind of guy than I am a Schoenberg or the composer Anton von Webern, whom you mention in your song. I'm much more of a Berg guy because he's writing romantic music with it. Unfortunately, and he died very tragically, I think it was an insect bite that became septic. Let me look this up. His name is Alban Berg, B-E-R-G.
Uh-huh.
He sort of looks like a Germanic Stephen Fry.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he died in 1935. So obviously that's like predates... It doesn't predate the Third Reich, but it predates sort of the invasion of Poland. He didn't really see a lot of like what became of sort of Germanic music at the time of the persecution and things like Kristallnacht or the degenerate art scene. So his music's not quite as ugly, to be honest. Like for lack of a better word, Alban Berg's music tends to be just a little bit more beautiful. So yeah, so he passed away. So Alban Berg passed away in 1935, and then 10 years later, and Anton Webern died. So Anton Webern was actually shot by an American soldier. So he was out beyond curfew. There's discussion either way as to like how much of a nationalist was someone like Webern. I mean, these were discussions that I had with Sam Adler, and you know, it's complicated, right? Because you know, even someone like Sam himself, who is Jewish and his father was a cantor in a synagogue, said that there was this time period in which like his high school teachers were like, yes, they were removing these sort of Jewish heads of state, these Jewish centers of power. And he said, for a period of time, my high school teacher was the former head of Germanics at Heidelberg University. He said, they got us by saying like, here, you get your best. We'll just do this, you know, sort of separate and what have you. Right. It was a really tumultuous time, and anyway, Webern was shot out because he was out beyond curfew, and then Schoenberg himself, the older of the three, sort of second Viennese school, was the one that was able to sort of immigrate to the United States and sort of like, as I mentioned, sort of lived in L.A. Anyway, I know this is sort of like a grim, it like took sort of a little bit of a grim turn to discuss these particular composers, although...
It is a grim form of music.
That's what I said. Ugly music for an ugly time, right? Like, but someone like Webern was really into writing like really, really short pieces that were like, as Stravinsky described, like little crystals. Mm-hmm. Berg wrote music that was very romantic and sort of like utilized some of these tools for romanticism. And then Schoenberg sort of like moved like Stravinsky did into eras of neoclassicism, and even toward the end of his life really stopped writing in this way. So it's no one way of working. Trap music is not all rap. Like string quartets, they're not all in C major. In the same way that no other musical form is bound to the tools of its own organization, 12-tone music is not the case. I don't know. I would probably revisit it as a composer in my life again. I like what you guys did with it with regards to making it a sort of a conversational point in describing maybe some of the dissonance that we find in our own romantic relationships, like relatability. Mm. Musical dissonance being something like the perseverance of a relationship. Like I get that you're different from me, but I'm gonna do what I can to find middle ground, right? And you use musical repertoire as a really wonderful. We listen to Varese or Messiaen, right? Messiaen and his bird songs are the thing that you end up sort of like landing on as like this really wonderful kind of like medium. That's really beautiful. And I think that that's actually completely appropriate to even approach this music in general. Like there's something out there for everybody, you know?
And I really appreciate you taking time to connect these dots and everything.
Sure, of course.
The connective tissue that has been highlighted in this conversation, everyone's learned something new. I've learned something new. Ken, you probably haven't learned a ton new compared to what we've learned new, but there's like things you thought about that you hadn't connected in your own life. And
oh, for sure.
And you probably connected some ideas just because that's what conversation does. And Aaron, absolutely. You've been studying this from knowing nothing to doing a podcast on it, which you've gone from improvement award. like it's kind of like the, you know, like it, I love it. I love it. It's a, it, and you know more than I do about many aspects of it, which is why I was like, we need to talk to Ken. So, sure. Or Kenneth Stewart, I should say, you know, for all the listeners.
Yeah. So kennethdstewart.com is my website. It's a weird sort of funny thing. I am one of those middle initial composers, or at least I was in grad school.
We all have a middle initial at work.
Yeah, exactly, right? So like it's all good. Please reach out, send me a line. I just love nerding out about music, and honestly, I'm just really grateful that you guys have enabled me in the last better part of a couple hours to just nerd out on music, and let's be clear.
So thank you, Ken.
You're welcome.
For being a part of this. Aaron, any final words?
Yeah, this has been great. I really I learned a lot.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Aaron.
This is fascinating stuff. So yeah, thank you very much, Ken.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I've got all your albums. So
I look forward to the albums you will make.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Yeah. All
right. Good work. Try
We have concluded our interview.
Yes.
With Ken Stewart. Thank you for learning all about my good friend. Ken, thank you for telling us about your life, because there are many people in this world who I think the rest of the world needs to know. And Ken, you are one of those experts, musicians and creators and collaborators. And everyone has learned about the things that you do specifically that isn't in common with me, because, you know, you grow up together, but we always do different things. And so if you can follow Ken's music online and anywhere we have told you about it,
all right,
let's play the song.
Here's 12-tone girl.
My girlfriend is pretty amusing. Don't get her talking about music. She's got a constant habit going on about Milton Babbitt. She always gets the last word, and it's always about Schoenberg. I just wanna get out there and live, but she's transfixed on the music of Andre Bucharest Liel.
Who? Well, I tried to talk about Verklekhnov.
Verklekhnov?
And how much that early stuff did rock.
Oh, yeah.
And I fell for the organized sound Edgard Varese captured and found.
Love at first sight. Yeah.
But she runs away at the mention of Prokofiev.
Yeesh.
Adams and Glass to her are just cheap knockoffs.
Ouch.
Anton Webern makes her happiest.
Well, he's pretty
since
good.
He guided Hartman, Carl Amadeus.
But I don't know who he is.
Play it, boys. It's kind of like Mozart, only not at all.
Transcribed so many bird songs. We walked a path of happiness following Stravinsky's Rite of Spring.
Sounds pretty. But all that early barbarism grated her.
It's brutal.
While my tonal brain pined for more.
I just needed tonal
Willie
music.
Nelson and some Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Some fiddle at a good old music bench.
That's the life right there. YOLO.
Thank you for listening to that song. You may have heard amazing drum parts by Adam Pasquale. He was in a band called Psychedelphia years ago. He works with a lot of musicians in the greater Philly area right now. He is one of my favorite drummers. He plays fast, complicated with his heart. He plays simple, all these things. But you know, I knew him from the jam band world, and this song wanted that. So
yeah.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Adam. Good work.
Word of the day. This is not our last word of the day, but it is our final episode outlining our entire album. And if you've been on this journey with us, thank you. Yeah.
All right. My word of the day is atonal.
Okay. My word of the day, I believe, bitonal.
Ooh, what does that mean?
That means you have two different key signatures at once.
Oh.
Yeah. Very nice. If you're a folk musician or jazz musician, it's just a compound chord, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's end this thing. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to
The Nathans and Roncast.
Sponsored by Michael Roncat.
Meow.
Peace.
My baby's gonna take a 12-point turn.